Ask anybody who spent any time around kids. There have always been kids who are more energetic than the others around them, kids who seem to have trouble focusing. In today's world, many of those children may meet the parameters of the diagnosis for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Today's guests examine ADHD and how society deals with it from several angles. Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler are the co-authors of the book, The ADHD Explosion: Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Stephen Hinshaw is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and holds a position in the psychiatry department at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Hinshaw, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Richard Scheffler is with us as well. He's a distinguished professor of health economics and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, with a focus on healthcare markets and consumer welfare. Richard, welcome to you.
Good morning.
So lay out the baselines, if one of you would. How big of an explosion and over what time? Dr. Hinshaw, let's talk about this from the psychology perspective first.
So we know from a big national survey that's been done and repeated over the last 10 years that parents, not just parents at clinics or bringing their kids in, but a nationally representative sample, in 2003 and then 2007 and again in 2012, parents are reporting a 41% increase in the number of their own 4 to 17-year-olds who've received an ADHD diagnosis within a 9-year period. And if that's not an explosion, we're not sure what is, because ADHD had already shown a lot of growth back in the 1980s and 1990s. So the big question is this what we call true prevalence increase? Are there really that many more cases? Or is it instead being diagnosed more and more frequently to get accommodations, to get services, and too often on the basis of very brief, cursory, 10 to 12-minute examinations, quote-unquote, in a pediatrician's office? It clearly seems as though it's the latter. The diagnosis is getting more popular. There may be other reasons why we're finding more true cases, but not 42% or so in a decade.
The foreword in the book makes mention of ADHD being a contested behavior, not a true disorder. Is there still some argument about what constitutes ADHD?
Richard, do you want to take that?
Sure, I'll make a comment on that and then back to Steve on that. I think the problem with diagnosing ADHD is also true for other mental health disorders. We don't have a blood test. We don't have an X-ray, a CAT scan, or urine test, so it's a judgmental diagnosis based on criteria set up by psychologists and psychiatrists and pediatricians. And so there's a bit of judgment involved in it, and so there's always controversy around that because different people have different sense of what judgments are. And to diagnose ADHD, there's a list of symptoms, some 30, 40 symptoms, and then one scores whether the child or anybody has that symptom, for example, how impulsive they are, problems focusing and acting out, and executive function problems. But these are all judgments, and then there's a criteria of a white line put there saying, well, if they have 24 of these or whatever number, they have ADHD, and if they have 23, they don't. So whenever you have something that's diagnosed like that, there's likely to be controversy around it.
So, Dr. Hinshaw, is there a list that changes from time to time of aspects of the diagnosis? Is that something that is kind of hardwired into the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual? Is it changing? And was it DSM-5 we're up to now?
Right. So back in 1952, DSM-1 came out. There were precisely two disorders of childhood and adolescence, adjustment reaction and schizophrenic reaction. And then you fast forward 30, 40 years to DSM 3, 4, and 5, and there's 100 pages or more of childhood onset conditions. ADD came about in DSM 3, 1980, became ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, in the 90s. And then there weren't really many changes between DSM 4 and DSM 5 that just came out last spring, just about a year ago. But to emphasize what Richard said, the same is true for bipolar disorder. No one doubts the seriousness and suicide risk of it, or schizophrenia. Brain scan studies are more and more every day showing real brain differences between people with and without ADHD, people with and without bipolar disorder. But brain scans are not yet sufficiently advanced for you to go in and your particular brain signature definitively gives you a diagnosis. We're 50-plus years away from that. And unlike other forms of medicine, the criteria for psychiatric conditions will always involve behaviors, and with ADHD, behaviors in classroom settings. So you can't remove context and some judgment from the process. But if you do it right, I'm not talking about 10 minutes in a pediatrician's office, but very firm, validated ratings, observations in schools, a thorough history with the family to rule out the many kinds of normative and abnormal conditions, even including abuse, that might mimic ADHD, the diagnosis can be made reliably. And when it's accurate, these kids, who then become teens and adults, are at serious risk for academic problems, social problems, accidental injury, very checkered employment histories. We'd like to think that ADHD is thinking outside the box and a set of hidden gifts, but too often the poor executive control, the poor decision-making, the poor judgment, and the impulse control problems, as well as the inattentiveness, make life really difficult.
Much more to talk about with our guests, Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler, the co-authors of the book, The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange with Drs. Hinshaw and Scheffler to talk about ADHD with you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are the co-authors of the book, The ADHD Explosion. We're talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The book is subtitled Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Stephen Hinshaw is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Richard Scheffler, a professor of health economics, also at UC Berkeley. They are the co-authors of the book and our guests, and you can join in at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Scheffler, when we were talking about the rise in cases, and I believe it was a 40-something percent increase that Dr. Hinshaw cited, are there rises in other things? Like the fact is that we're seeing more cases of autism diagnosed as well, too, aren't we?
We are, and I think that has something to do with the fact that we have better tools to diagnose that and more attention to that. There has been a huge increase in autism as well, and that has a different set of factors related to it, but there's no doubt we're seeing this astronomical increases from a much lower base, I might say. It's not quite as common to find autism in the population. I think Steve can correct me, but I think the numbers are basically about, one out of 40. And here, at the ADHD explosion, we're talking about rates that we report in the book, about one out of nine kids under 17 and one out of six boys. So the explosion here, I think, is much more important.
All right. The book delivers four fundamental messages you lay out here. One, ADHD is a real medical condition. Two, only diligent and thorough assessment distinguishes ADHD from other conditions. Three, medication alone is less effective than meds plus skill building. And four, rates of ADHD and treatment vary widely from place to place. You were just talking about, I want to get to the part about assessing it, though, and diagnosing it, Dr. Hinshaw, because you talked about observing behavior in school. This sounds like it would actually be a very lengthy process, potentially involving more than one person, because, for example, you could ask the teachers to give their observations of the kids in school, assuming you don't have a time for the psychologist to get to the school and observe the behavior.
Well, the DSM, is very clear about this. You cannot make a valid diagnosis unless there's clear evidence that this child, or again, adolescent or adult in the workplace, is impaired in at least two different settings. If it's just problems at home, but the kid is saying, thank you, ma'am, to the teacher at school, well, then we're going to look to home discipline as maybe the primary locus. But if there's impulse control problems, real difficulties focusing, erratic ups and downs in performance at home and at school and in the peer group, then we start to focus in on what are the issues within the child that make it so hard for him or her to adapt. Yes, you can't do this talking to families for a few minutes. If you can't make a school observation, you at least get systematized rating checklists from not only this year's teacher, but last year's teacher or the one the year before, too, to get the consistency of patterns. There's some psychological and processing tests that help pinpoint visual versus auditory strategies. How is the kid doing achievement-wise? What about depression or serious acting out behaviors? You need to look at comorbid conditions, too. It's going to take a couple of hours to put this information together, but our contention, and a strong one, is if we don't pay now, we're going to pay in spades later. A thorough assessment can really get treatment that's vitally needed for those kids who need it, but will also prevent this creeping prevalence with a lot of medications now prescribed for kids who are right on the border or don't even have the condition at all, which leads to another problem altogether, which is the rates of what we call diversion, the use of these stimulant medications by college and even high school students who don't have ADHD but are looking for a performance edge, which really incurs at that point the risk for substance abuse.
The first story in the introduction in the book, who was Richard Fee and how typical was his case?
So Richard Fee was written up last year in the New York Times by Alan Schwartz, who's done a series of news pieces and features on ADHD. And Richard Fee was a pre-med student who very questionably had ADHD, never really had much of a formal diagnosis. But starting in college to help with studying and term papers and pre-med courses, got a prescription for stimulants. The dose increased. You can now look back and say he was developing tolerance and a pattern of addiction. Doctors, without thorough evaluations at all, kept increasing the dose. He clearly became disorganized and really mentally unbalanced, the way that stimulant abuse can lead to, and ended up committing suicide at the age of 24. It's kind of a poster child story for what can go wrong if we don't diagnose, if we pump out medications, which in valid cases can be lifesavers, really helpful. But for people without ADHD, they can lead to addiction. And again, it's that horror story that no one wants to hear about. And if it's your family member, it's a tragedy. And it really showed us, to lead off the book, how in some ways dependent on stimulants and performance enhancers our society has become.
So was there a point in time at which it just became more? I mean, I can't imagine it happened overnight, certainly, but I mean, is there a period you can point to as a transition period in which it just became much more likely that people were going to start prescribing some of these stimulants for young people with the symptoms of ADHD?
Well, this is Steve again. I'll just answer quickly and then put it over to Richard. Most social history doesn't go up in a straight line. It ebbs and flows. There was a big controversy back in Omaha, Nebraska, over 40 years ago, that about 5 to 10% of all school kids in Omaha were getting stimulant prescriptions. And then in the 80s, things calmed down a bit, a big rise in prescriptions, a lot of protests. The Scientologists were protesting all mental illness and all medications. Things went down for a period of time. Then 20 years ago, school policies changed. ADHD became a condition that would get you services. Medicaid policies changed. Kids with lower incomes could get assessment and services. And for the last 20 years, it's been a fairly steady rise. And then in the last 10, as we pointed out earlier, the rise has been skyrocketing. So it's up and down, but we're in the upslope right now.
And Richard,
just to add what Steve has said, I completely agree. We were trying to understand this 40% increase in rates, and we looked around at the usual suspects. Does it have to do with something in the healthcare system? There's a little bit of that. Most healthcare plans now cover the diagnosis for ADHD and the medication. Unfortunately, they don't cover as well the behavioral therapy that Dr. Henshaw and I are recommending in the book. And the Medicaid programs and California, we call them Medi-Cal, insurance for the poor covers it, and Obamacare covers it. So that it certainly helps the rates go up, but it doesn't really explain a 40% spike in the rates. And we looked at other contenders about what was happening in psychology, the diagnosis criteria and the like. We discussed that earlier. But the big aha for us, and maybe what we might call a potential smoking gun, was school policy. So we looked at a map of the United States, and you see huge variations in the rates of diagnosis by states. To simplify it, they're essentially higher in the South and much lower in the West Coast and in the northern part of the United States. And there didn't seem to be any logical reason in health policy or in the health system to explain that. But when we looked at things about the education system, there became the potential smoking gun for us. So the short of the story is in the 1990s, states decided to tie their budgets, we call it accountability laws, tie their school budgets, the budgets that the school would get from the state, to performance measures like high school graduation rates or test rates. And there's a lot of variation across. Some 30-some-odd states did this. And a huge number of the earlier adopters of changing the way they budgeted schools. Before, they would just give the budget to the school based on the number of students they had. And here they were changing it to the performance, as I mentioned, graduation rates and test scores. 30-some-odd states did that. The early adopters of this philosophy were in the South, and there's where you see the spike up of the rates. Later on, President Bush picked up this idea, his No Child Left Behind policy, and other states adopted it as well. So when we analyzed the data and looked at it, this explains a lot of the spike in the rates in the last 10 or 15 years.
And the comparison you make is between North Carolina and California, and I think it might have surprised a few people to find out that California is not the one that is diagnosing ADHD more often. North Carolina is.
Yeah, North Carolina is high, but I don't want to pick North Carolina. We could have picked Florida or South Carolina.
Right, make that clear in the
book.
But
we wanted to make a state-by-state comparison, and we picked California, obviously, because Steve and I are here. And there's lots of reasons California is low, and some of it's they were late adopters of the education policy. California tends to be late on these things in general, and so the other issue is California has a cultural issue. We obviously have a huge population of Hispanics, and Hispanics generally use less mental health services, period, not only in ADHD but in other services as well. So the proportion of Hispanics certainly has to do with lowering our rates, but we think it's really education policy in California has been reluctant to use these performance measures, and therefore they're low. The West Coast generally is low, but California is particularly low, and we think that's the reason for it. There might be others, but those are the main reasons.
Richard Scheffler and Stephen Henshaw are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Scheffler is a professor of health economics. Dr. Henshaw, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley with a similar position at UC San Francisco. Their book is The ADHD Explosion. We're talking to them here on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join in at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Henshaw, are we still using ADD and ADHD, or is it all wrapped into ADHD, and are there degrees of it? Can you be reported as having severe ADHD or mild ADHD?
Well, the first part of your question is this alphabet soup. Is it ADD? Is it ADHD? The technical term now is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which comes in a form without a lot of hyperactivity. That's attention deficit disorder. So that's why it's a little bit confusing. More commonly, it comes in a form where the child is not only poorly focused and inattentive, but very impulsive and often pretty active too, the so-called combined form, the combination of inattention and impulsivity. Regardless of which particular alphabet soup you use, and ADHD would be the preferred term, this rise in prevalence and this great regional variation, I just wanted to make a comment or two on what Richard so aptly said. First, recent data from California, from Kaiser Permanente, shows that, just as Richard pointed out, traditionally, as in other forms of mental health, Hispanics have the lowest rates of diagnosis and utilization. But in California, Hispanics are the fastest rising ethnic group with ADHD diagnosis. So this is going to become ancient history pretty soon. We're finding pretty equal rates now across ethnic groups. And again, many of these diagnoses are being made in a very quick and cursory fashion, which leads us to believe that when you get policy that really emphasizes test scores to the exclusion of everything else, the big spikes we found in those states adopting were not for all kids, but especially for the poorest kids in those states, those public school kids in a lot of Title I schools. In the olden days, ADHD was a white male middle-class diagnosis. Now that it's equal opportunity, there's actually incentive for districts to try to help kids get diagnosed, especially some of the kids near the poverty line, to boost those test scores, or in some cases even to get those kids' scores excluded from the district's average test score. Some districts are actually gaming the system. So that's a more nefarious interpretation of what could happen.
But that raises the question, when there is a diagnosis and medication is given to calm a kid down with ADHD, is it sometimes, well, the question then is it done for that child's benefit, or is it often done sometimes for the benefit of the rest of the kids in the class so that they can focus better on their studies?
Well, yeah, I think that's again, if I could start, I actually have to leave a couple minutes early to give my last lecture of the term, so I'll say one more thing. The critics will say this is for the benefit of the teacher and the rest of the class, and we're just trying to calm down misbehavior. In fact, if medications are given to an appropriately diagnosed kid or adolescent or adult with the right dosage and careful monitoring, kids now are showing better judgment. Their test scores actually do go up. They're able to maintain friendships. This can be a lifesaver. But unless you add these other behavioral treatments, you're not really teaching skills. So I think it's a myth to say that the medications are just for the benefit of calmer classrooms and to make teachers' lives easier. But with quick and dirty diagnoses, sometimes it may be expedient to give medication, and that's not the good state of affairs.
All right, so is that your farewell statement there, Dr. Hinshaw?
Stand for a few more minutes, but okay. I just wanted to get that in.
Okay, good. Richard Sheffler?
I can stay to the end of the hour because I taught my last class yesterday.
Oh, okay. Well, we're learning a lot about the schedules at UC Berkeley with today's program. Let's take some calls here. We have Kevin on the road near Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the ADHD explosion with Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Sheffler.
Yeah, I'm a retired marriage family therapist, and I have a lot of teachers in my family, and it's a very interesting subject, and I agree with everything you guys are saying. One thing I wanted to bring up is if you would mention, if you're aware of the British treatment protocol for this diagnosis, heavily involves neurofeedback, which is a process which can speed up the frontal lobe and the speed of the executive function in kids. And unlike medication, the effect, though it takes longer, it doesn't go away when the treatment is stopped.
All right, so feedback, neural feedback then.
So that's a better question for Steve, I think.
Yeah,
sure, okay.
So neurofeedback's a really intuitively appealing idea. If ADHD is a disorder of poor executive function and lack of self-regulation, what better way than to help train your own brain, change the way its brain waves are exhibiting themselves, to teach yourself better self-regulation. So there's two issues, however. Number one, no treatment to date, one-on-one, talk therapy, neurofeedback, teaching better memory functioning, for ADHD has ever really persisted outside that clinical one-on-one setting. The holy grail for ADHD is to do what we call generalization and maintenance. Can it work for homework? Can it work on the soccer field? Number two, as appealing as neurofeedback is, some early data from the most definitive clinical trial, which doesn't just compare neurofeedback training to no treatment, but compares neurofeedback training to the same skull cap on and looking at brain waves and trying to regulate it, but the feedback given to the individual is random rather than truly reflective of their brain functioning, the results have been equal so far. So there may be actually a very big expectancy effect of getting the wires going and the computer screen going. We don't know definitively yet if we can really retrain the brain through neurofeedback for ADHD. So it's in the category of promising but not established treatment.
All right, we have a lot more to talk about treatment and training and certainly causes as well of ADHD. We haven't touched on that yet. Our guests, Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler, are the co-authors of the book, The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. We'll come back and talk more with them and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today to the co-authors of the book, The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. The authors are Richard Scheffler, a distinguished professor of health economics and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Stephen Hinshaw is a professor of psychology also at the University of California, Berkeley, and a position in the psychiatry department at UC San Francisco. You can join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Drs. Hinshaw and Scheffler.
Good morning. Have there been any studies done as to correlation and or causation of infant viewing of fast-moving screens, you know, television, computer screens, things of that nature?
Mm-hmm. All right, so now we're talking about causes, one of the areas we need to get into. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Dr. Hinshaw?
So we know that babies born at very low birth weight or preterm babies or babies who've been exposed to maternal alcohol or nicotine during their in utero period, those babies, as they grow up to be kids, have pretty greatly increased risk of ADHD as well as other learning and motor disorders. So the early years, I mean, genetics are highly involved, a lot of inheritance of focus versus not. Early life circumstances and biological insults can also play a role. What we don't know is what the caller provocatively raises about, look at our culture today versus, forget 50 years ago, even 10 or 15 years ago. Multiple screens, forget 500 channels, maybe it's 5,000. Social media, even when you watch the national news, your attention span about 4 seconds is about what we expect now. Maybe all of us are somewhat less focused and being pushed to multitasking and fragmented tasking more. That may well be the case. It's hard to do definitive studies of this because we'd have to do brain scans of millions of people at different age cohorts across the country. But it may be that this changing culture of media and screens and social media provides the backdrop against which early inborn differences in attention and focus are played out. So it may be an advantage in some ways for some people with attention deficits because of this fast tasking now required, but it's also difficult. People with ADHD look like they're doing a really good job playing video games. They stay hyper-focused, but actually their performance isn't as good as people without ADHD. It's a complicated issue. Maybe we're all less attentive, but I don't think that's the fundamental cause of ADHD.
But there's no genetic cause that we know of, no bacterial, viral, protein, anything like that?
Well, genes have a lot to do with it. Identical twins are much more likely to both have ADHD than fraternal twins. In adoption studies, it's the biological relatives that are at risk, not the adoptive relatives. But there's no single gene. This isn't Huntington's disease. This isn't Down syndrome. It's multiple genes interacting together and maybe being epigenetically pushed by early experience that causes this huge bell curve. I mean, you know, some of your colleagues are highly focused and some are utterly distracted, most in the middle, probably a lot of early biological reasons that puts us somewhere on the curve. But then when society started making all kids go to school, compulsory education, that provided the real cultural change where ADHD became in existence, because now kids who can't do this well really get noticed.
Expand on that one, if you would, Dr. Scheffler. I thought that was a fascinating part of the book, that compulsory education was one of the factors in noticing children with problems focusing.
Well, I think that's right. We finally have to put the kids in the seat. Compulsory education means mass education. Everybody has to have a basic education, and so, kids weren't wired and genes weren't wired to sit in the classrooms for 6 or 8 hours, to sit still for an hour. And when we look at the broad history of ADHD, that's the marker where all of a sudden we see the beginning of the rate. So it's definitely environmentally triggered by educational policy.
But you're not advocating against compulsory education here, are you?
No, we're not.
Okay.
Of course not. But we're advocating some schools and some policies to look at more flexibility in the classroom, and particularly for kids who have these kind of problems and others, to allow them to function better in schools. And so we definitely think that the schools can adapt better to the kids rather than to continue to push kids to adapt to rigid schools.
All right, let's take another call. We have Daniel in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Scheffler and Stephen Henshaw, the co-authors of The ADHD Explosion.
Hi. This is Daniel. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. So I'm a 40-year-old adult who was diagnosed first time with ADHD at age of 6, but my father wouldn't... He wouldn't allow the doctors to give the diagnosis, and over the course of my childhood, there were two different doctors who diagnosed me, and neither time would he was non-accepting of the diagnosis, if you will. Now, I've gone on to have, a very productive life, strong military career, college, master's degree, and done quite well, and never have been treated for the condition. But one of the things I've noticed is, for me, personally, I have a lot more of the hyperactivity side, but I actually have the ability to focus very intensely when I need to in a way that is almost greater than my peers who do not have this condition. And that's something that friends of mine who know me very well have oftentimes been jealous of, this ability I have to become hyper-focused around things in a way that allows me to absorb material very effectively. I was wondering if your guests might comment on whether or not they've seen that kind of thing before, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for that, Daniel. Appreciate hearing from
you're
you.
Welcome.
So this is Steve. I'll kick in before I run off to my final lecture. And
okay.
So I think what this caller's case, obviously very brief and can't make a diagnosis over the phone and radio, shows is there's different forms of ADHD. Most of the time, there's major problems in attention and focus. Sometimes you do get hyper-focused. But this gentleman seems to have this, what we might call the hyperactive, impulsive form of the condition. The motor's revving at a high idle a lot of the time, but he's able to really super focus some of the time. As he said, some of his colleagues wish they could do that. So inattention on the one hand and impulsive hyperactive behaviors on the other, although they often go together, they don't always. And he may have had a form of this condition that maybe some of the risk for accidental injury and some of that high activity level might have placed him at risk. But as he's gone on in his educational and vocational career, he's used that ability to focus to his advantage. So there's a lot under the sun. ADHD doesn't look just one way. This is the importance, back to the beginning of the program, of a thorough diagnosis to find where strengths and weaknesses lie.
All right, Stephen Henshaw is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and holds a position in the psychiatry department at UC San Francisco. We'll say goodbye to you now because you have to get off to that class. And thanks so much for taking this time
with
us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right,
bye.
So now to Dr. Scheffler, who will stay with us for the last few minutes of the program, and I'll take a call here from Jonathan in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Perhaps it would be more beneficial to these young people to reduce some of the refined chemicals in their life rather than add additional refined chemicals called pharmaceuticals. I say that based on personal experience. There's books in the Jackson County Library System by Leonard Sachs, Dr. Leonard Sachs, S-A-X. His books document how plastic specifically drinking from plastic containers is causing a lot of trouble. And there's other places that, you know, a lot of toxic chemicals people find just in the plastic seat the kid is sitting in the classroom. We're all exposed to enormous amounts of refined toxic chemicals in food, in water, in containers, in classrooms, in houses, and some people are getting overwhelmed by it. It's just more than they can handle, and they get diagnosed in various different ways.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks for the call, Jonathan. Appreciate it. So, Dr. Scheffler, as you look at the data from across the country, I mean, are we compiling good statistics on what we think some of the environmental causes, if there are any, could be for ADHD?
You know, we don't see any direct scientific evidence of environmental pollution and toxic chemicals, though they are serious. Your caller is exactly right. I think this is a major problem, but it's not directly related to ADHD. We don't see that as a cause and effect. I do understand his point about medication and having kids take more medication. We are concerned about over-medication. The national rate, believe it or not, is 70%, 69, 70%. So if you get a diagnosis, there's a 7 out of 10 chance that you're going to be put on some kind of medication. These are powerful medications, Concerta, Ritalin, Adderall. They are regulated by the federal government. They're very, very serious and powerful, and we think that we have to be really careful with the diagnosis. We keep on repeating that and have it properly done, because if you're diagnosed, you're going to be put on a very, very powerful medication. If you need it, it's a lifesaver. And if you don't, there's really no reason to take it, and it can have a lot of adverse effects for you and very little benefit.
Well, it seems like, and you point out in the book, that there are periodic outrages, stories in the media that bring about a bit of controversy, dating back, you take one back to 1970 here, a New York Times story about diagnosis and medication rates. I think that was the one based in Omaha. And so is there a response after each of these outrages and a change in behavior, or does it seem like it's otherwise been a fairly steady march in increasing the rates of diagnosis and medication?
Yeah, I think when there is a public outcry and a pushback of things like that, we do see the rates moderate just temporarily, but it doesn't really last. The rates continue to march on, and the line is pretty much straight up. So, yes, controversies do raise questions, but parents, this book is written for parents and healthcare professionals and providers. There's so many reasons why children need help in school, and they need help with their peer group. When you see a child with ADHD, you can understand the problems and that the parent has in deciding how to deal with this child, what to do, should I medicate them, should I follow the advice of the doctors. I mean, it's a heart-wrenching decision because it changes the life of the child. They're told they have a diagnosis. They're told they have some kind of problem. They're different from other kids. They're put on medication. But basically, even with the doubts and the controversies, these numbers continue to go up, and as Dr. Henshaw pointed out, and we write in our book, the rate now of diagnosis and treatment for blacks and whites is exactly the same. It wasn't 10 years ago, for sure. The rate for whites was much higher. The stigma is going down somewhat, and that's part of the explanation. And now the Hispanic rates are picking up dramatically, as we pointed out, in California, so we expect those to approach the black-white rate as well. So there's so many factors that build it up to continue to go that even these controversies slow things up, but it's only temporary.
Is it a case of you have the insurance that'll pay for the medication or other treatment, and you got the medication to do it? Essentially, the old line of, you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
No, that's a very good statement. Yeah, the problem is the good thing is insurance covers it. Public insurance, private insurance, Obamacare covers it. the diagnosis, and it covers the medication, so there's no doubt that that stimulates the use of the medication. It doesn't cover so well the behavioral therapy that we think is necessary to really have a complete treatment, and so we need to have better reimbursement of that. But you're right, the hammer here looks like medication, and that's basically what's done.
And so the costs over, I mean, obviously there are costs to society. You're paying for the medication, paying for the treatment, et cetera. But the costs to an individual loom large in this book as well. I mean, what are we talking about happening to a person and their life and their earnings potential over the course of that life with ADHD and with ADHD untreated for that matter?
Yeah, the broadest sense for parents and looking at their kids is that if your child has ADHD, it affects their life chances, the chances of them being successful in whatever they want to do in life is reduced because they're less productive, they have fewer friends, they act out in social situations, they're often ostracized, they have trouble in school, and so the parent has to look at the best chances for their kid, their child to be successful. This is what all parents want. This is a heart-rending kind of decision. They need help from the teachers and from healthcare professionals, but clearly people who have ADHD is not treated. They have lower wages. They have higher unemployment rates. They unfortunately have higher rates of drug addiction, crime, jails, and also divorce rates and the like. I mean, it's a really bleak future if someone with ADHD is not treated properly and appropriately and early on.
All right, a lot to consider in the book, The ADHD Explosion. Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler wrote it. Dr. Scheffler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about travel plans that encompass the whole state of Jefferson. At 8:30, we'll talk about the issue of who is a journalist in today's world. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of a book about adoption carried in our hearts. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.